That's the idea that's wrongly translated into English as faith or belief, which is the first of all mitzvahs. That's the beginning of any spiritual pathway. And the first obligation of a Jew, and in fact, if you think about it rationally, it's the place you have to begin, because if you don't have a concept that there's a higher reality, then nothing spiritual makes any sense. You behave the way you think you should, but there's no higher aspiration. So to establish the fact, or the belief, if you want to use that word, that there's something that transcends what we can see and touch and deal with physically and rationally, that's the first, right? That's the beginning of any spiritual pathway. Now, what we said was, very briefly, as follows. Where we're holding now in the discussion is as follows. We said that the Jewish pathway is not that there's any such thing as belief. Right? That's the first fact. Secular, non-Jewish world, they have a concept called belief, which means something blind that you believe in without being able to ever know. There's no such Jewish idea. We said that the Torah approach to it is that, first of all, there's knowledge. Spiritual knowledge. You have to have an intimate, essential knowledge that there's something that transcends what your senses can deal with. And then we said that the word emunah doesn't mean belief, because if you have knowledge, there's nothing left to believe in. What it means is faithfulness to the knowledge, right? Ne'eman means loyal, or loyalty. It means that once a person has the knowledge, then the ordeal becomes being faithful to that knowledge, even when the knowledge doesn't seem to be correct. That means when you go through ordeals, through difficulties, when what you believed, or what you felt, or what you knew, clearly at some stage now is called into question. But that is the work of emunah. It means being loyal to something, as we try to illustrate. It's like a person who starts off a human relationship, let's say like a marriage, a love that he has for someone else, and the love begins, and then perhaps you could be separated for many years. Right? That means that the knowledge definitely was there. But then there are many years of commitment and faithfulness to someone who's the reinforcement of which you don't have. In other words, the experience of the relationship you don't have now. You have the abstract knowledge that it's correct and true, and that's what we translate as trust, or faithfulness, or whatever English word one chooses to use. That's the work and that's the difficulty. But if there's no point of knowledge that starts the thing off, well then it's ridiculous. Imagine a person being faithful to somebody that he imagines. And imagine, you follow, somebody imagining that there is somebody who loves him and he loves that person. That person may or may not exist. But that's futility. That's stupidity. And therefore we don't have the concept that you have to decide to believe in something and then commit the rest of your life to being faithful to that thing if you're never really quite sure whether that thing exists. I mean, that's just being stupid. And therefore the Torah idea is that before you commit yourself and be prepared to give your life to such a thing, you have to have a point of fixity, a point of knowledge on which you build that faithfulness. That was the beginning of the discussion. We then tried to look at the idea of where the blindness is, since the word is translated, after all, into a concept that has something blind about it. There must be some truth to that idea. We tried to explain that there are many dimensions to this. One idea is the blindness of working in the dark. It means even though you have the knowledge behind you, but right now you don't see it. That's one element of blindness. The truth is that the depth of this element of the idea is the most important element of the whole discussion, and Mr. Shem will deal with that next time. We agreed to try and work through the rational levels before getting to the transcendent level, but we have to know that what we've been discussing up to now, what we'll try and discuss this evening, are not the essential place in which a person has emunah. In other words, where a person has intimate, essential knowledge of something that transcends his own being, that's in a meditational, transcendent form of knowledge. That's an enormously difficult subject to discuss, and we'll have to leave that, Mr. Shem, for the next time. People who've had any experience in a meditational discipline or in Eastern systems have some aspects of that discussion much easier than people who haven't. That the Western mind is trained very much against non-rational thinking, and therefore there are tremendous obstructions to being able to transcend if a person has a Western type pattern of thinking. So we'll try and look at that as we progress. Most people, I'm sure, know that all Eastern wisdom comes from the Kabbalistic core. Now, we know that the Kabbalistic root of knowledge is what was handed to man at the beginning, and that split itself into various Eastern, mainly Eastern, pathways and ideas, each of which has tremendous depth of truth in it, based on a Kabbalistic source. Yet many deviations from the truth, which are negative and damaging, that we are not allowed to some that no one's allowed to follow and some that we as Jews are not allowed to be involved in. But there's a tremendous amount of truth out there. We have to use reference to those systems indirectly in order to understand the subject more deeply. Now let's look at the next step in the rational pathway. So again, let's get clear what we're aiming at. You're not aiming this evening to arrive at any, let's say, experience of something transcendent. Right? Even when we discuss that subject, we can hardly hope to actually achieve anything just from a discussion. But we can certainly point out the way, pathway. But when we consider the rational aspect, what we're trying to reach is the way the classical Jewish philosophers, the Khuzari, the Rambam, and others, they point out the pathway that a person can see from rational thought. But before a person arrives at an intimate, the example would be, before you marry someone, you have a rational, logical approach to the marriage. That means the person fits the bill of certain requirements that you have. Logically, the thing seems to be the right direction, the right step to take, but there's been no experience yet of sharing something in common. That's where we're holding now. That means all the rational pathway can do is show us that this is a worthwhile area to look in. But it can't give you any of the experiential dimension of what transcendence is. But let's follow it anyway. That's the way we have to begin. Last week what we did was we looked at the level called doubt. That means before a person can be sure that the knowledge on which he's basing his faithfulness is correct, before a person can know that, a person starts with a doubt that maybe it's correct. Last week we tried in detail to examine what is the correct course of action that a person who has a reasonable doubt should follow. That's the basis for this discussion. The next stage is, can we get more certain than just a doubt? Right? Even though we try to show that the possibility of something beyond is enough already to motivate development and to check it out, but there is a pathway that can take us to more than just a doubt. So let's try and examine it. Now the way to approach the subject is as follows. We said before that the pathway consists of first achieving some kind of knowledge. The knowledge itself is gained in incremental fashion. That means that you don't start off with the first half of a lifetime, let's say, achieving intense total knowledge, and then the second half being loyal to the knowledge. It doesn't work that well. The two work hand in hand. Like the mystics always say that the male and female halves of reality, which in this case referred to irrational and non-rational understandings, they always have to be married together before anything will be produced. Right? Even though the man comes first in the relationship, I don't mean in quality, I mean in time, in producing a child, the action and contribution and input of the male content comes first, and then it's the female that picks it up and continues the creation, but nevertheless, unless you have both functioning together, you don't have anything. And therefore, as one achieves the smallest amount of rational clarity, then there has to be immediately a translation into the spiritual or transcendent dimension, where a person grasps that as reality, even at a level that can't be apprehended rationally. A simple example would be, I will try not to go into this in more detail, but a simple example as background would be, when you approach the fact that 101 equals 2, you actually know it in two ways. You know it in a rational fashion like a computer does, but you also know that it's true, which a computer doesn't do. Well, they're two distinct elements of knowledge. We can't prove this in words, but if you're sensitive to the workings of your own consciousness, then you could definitely experience that. But first there's a 1 and 1 is 2 that you can prove externally. You can compute it, you can show it, you can demonstrate it in numbers and in objects. Right? That's it. But then there's the point at which it connects with your personality, right? In which you know that it's true in a sense that a machine can't ever know that. If you think about it, only those two elements of knowledge are useful only when each one has the other. If you have the computational aspect of 1 and 1 is 2, but you actually don't feel it to be true, that means it hasn't connected with your being, it's a dangerous piece of knowledge and you can't rely on it. On the other hand, if you have strongly developed the intuitional or the deeper knowledge of reality, but you don't have the figures, the computational element to put in, so then it's a wheel-spinning exercise because there's nothing concrete or tangible. Right? Both have to be developed together. So it's a much more complex pathway than it seems at first sight. It means the person has to engage himself in rational thought, and as each thing becomes clear in the rational world, it has to connect with the personality. That's why the mystics say that the way to approach this pathway is through Torah. In other words, classic example would be that while a person engages in rational inquiry, let's say you study Talmud, study Gemara, It's a very, very intense training in the rational. But it's approached in such a way that it actually impinges on the personality at the same time. And a person has to be working on his personality, that it should be a valid receptacle for the wisdom. If a person has wisdom in an external sense, it will never change him. If they have the desire to work on themselves, but they don't have the rational input, then they won't develop either. Now the Torah exercise is a marriage between the two. Right, that's why a person will be studying a piece of Gemara, and he might go through many pages of rational, mind-breaking exertion rationally, and then he'll suddenly come across a Kabbalistic or mystical piece where it's only intuitional sensing that can help. That both have to be developed at one and the same time. Another way to do it would be Torah study, combined with beginning to apply what one learns in the practical world. Because when the body's engaged, so then it drives it inward into the personality. As we tried to explain last night, if a person sits for hours and thinks about kindness and being kind, it won't make you a kindly individual. Right? But if you understand what it means and you get out and do it, so as you actually put it into practice, the action will drive in the ideas to a level where they both become part of the personality, but only if you actually practice it in the outside world. Understanding it and studying it rationally and thinking about it and so forth is irrelevant. Right? And that's what you see in the academic world. In the academic world, the idea is to rationalize and to be very sophisticated in the intellectual dimension, but there's no specific motivation to actually develop personally. It's just not part of the ethic. And therefore you certainly don't see personalities coming out of that world that are pure and holy personalities. I'm not saying you don't, you may, but it's not an inevitable consequence. And if you look at the intellectual world in the secular society, you'll see the same thing. You'll see that people who manage to be very, very sensitive poets and musicians and authors and so forth actually led a very, very basic and coarse personal life. Right? Then you examine their, see that the work they were doing on themselves was completely divorced from what they were producing on the pure intellectual plane. Torah is both of those in combination. That's what they mean when they say that it's the male and female halves that always have to be married together. Now, with that background, let's try and examine the first step on the pathway towards the knowledge. So the question we began with 3-4 weeks ago was, if the first requirement in achieving spiritual knowledge is to have rational knowledge, is to have the knowledge, before a person can engage in the activity of being loyal and standing by that knowledge, even in the face of death, the question is, how do you go about getting that knowledge? What is the Jewish approach to actually incorporating into your mind any of that knowledge? Rational knowledge, before we get to the mystical. And the Jewish approach to it is very, very clear. That it's a clearly mapped out pathway. And let's try and go some steps down that pathway. Bearing in mind all the time, I can't emphasize enough, that what we're trying to do is point out the road. Right? This is not yet taking the first step on the road. The first step on the road is a meditational exercise that happens during davening, and it happens during certain ecstatic moments in Torah learning, or it could be marriage. And there are various other ways a person can achieve some of these insights, having studied what that element in life is supposed to do. A person approaches marriage, certain aspects of marriage, understanding what one's supposed to learn from those things, but then you could have a very, very intense experience that actually leaves you in a way that you will never be the same again. Yeah? That's what we'll have to try and get to. But let's first try and see where the rational road is. Now, I hope the context is clear by now. Huh? Okay. Now, Judaism approaches this question in a very formal and clear way, right? And it's as follows. There are two avenues of rational inquiry that yield the knowledge. They both have to be used. In order of importance, they are as follows. We know that there's a transcendent reality because we met him. Right? We know, again, we experience, we know, we are certain, to the point that we're prepared to give our lives for it, that there's a higher aspect of reality that has certain demands, and with which we can connect and interrelate, because we actually experienced that reality. There was a moment, just one moment at Sinai, where we personally made contact with that being, and that never left us. Well, we'll have to come back to this in detail. The second aspect of the knowledge has nothing to do with that at all, but it consists of a rational, objective, unbiased examination of the physical world, with certain principles that underlie. If you know certain principles, you could then study certain aspects of physical reality, and they could lead you to the inevitable conclusion, rationally, inevitable conclusion, that there is a transcendence, absolutely inevitably. What the transcendence is exactly is not inevitable. Right? We'll have to examine that also. That means a person can definitely decide from the physical, as we tried to show last week, first of all, that it's possible, that you don't even need to make any effort, right, to show that the thing may be possible. But we can go much further from an examination of the rational world and show that there must be a transcendence. And let's examine that carefully. The next step, which is what that transcendent reality is and how it connects with you, that's a much more sensitive and refined exercise, which is not inevitable at the first level. Yeah? That's where we go. Now, let's start with area one. Area one is that we had a personal experience of this transcendent reality. Now, to understand that, and to have that become the first step in a road towards rational knowledge, we need two elements. And I'm sure you're ahead of me. The first element is to understand what that event was. Right? What is it purported to have been? And the second element is that I wasn't there. Right? I personally wasn't there. It's all very well that there may have been a generation of some millions of people who witnessed or experienced such an event, but I'm taking it on trust because I wasn't there. And that piece of the puzzle has to be supplied by an examination of the chain of transmission which claims that that event occurred. In other words, if we can be certain, or if we can have a high degree of reliability, of certainty, that the chain of transmission of that information checks out, right? If we can examine it rationally and see that the integrity of the chain is unassailable, then we can have a high degree of certainty or probability that the thing actually occurred. Are you with me? So we have to clinch both of those areas. And I know what you're thinking, and that is that it's going to be very hard to clinch these things rationally. Let's try. Let's see. Let's examine it. What I hope to achieve, what we want to get to, is the understanding, first of all, that it's not the way you thought about it before, radically opposite from the way we've been taught to think about it, first of all, and secondly, that it's a much more well-fitting pattern and picture, rationally, purely, coldly, intellectually, rationally, than one would imagine. Vastly different from any other claims on earth to a spiritual existence. Vastly different from any other claims. And to do this, we'll have to compare certain religions, which is an unpleasant business to have to do. But we'll have to look at certain elements that are around us in order to see where and why we differ. Now, let's try and build it up slowly, piece by piece. Again, we're not here to make a judgment on each piece of information. We're here to see what Torah says about this subject and then try and put it together objectively. And then, if we're lucky and we've done all that correctly, we're only just beginning to see the direction. That's all. Right? But nobody said it's easy. No one said this is an easy half-hour discussion that achieves spiritual knowledge. It's very hard work, and it's a lifetime's work to get any of the knowledge. At least. But the direction we have to look at. So let's check out, first of all, the Sinai experience, in a very panoramic way. What was it supposed to have been? And then let's try and check out whether we can rely on the fact that we've been told that it happened and what happened there. Okay? You agree with me? Those are the two elements that have to be examined. If the chain of transmission is reliable, we can then rely on what's supposed to have happened. Huh? We'll have to check it out. Let's first of all look at what we're told about that experience. And then let's see if we can check out the authority of those who handed it down to us. So the first thing to note is this, that when we consider this tradition of ours, that we stood at Sinai and we had a personal revelation, that means we experienced the transcendence directly. The first thing to understand is that before we get into the spiritual depth of it, which we'll try and discuss a little bit, the first thing is to understand that you have to take out of your mind any picture that you may have of what the world sells as the concept of a revelation. In other words, let's try and approach this rationally also. What the secular world teaches, and also the non-Jewish religious world, various religions, not excluding for the moment the Eastern Bloc, talking now Western religions, what they sell as revelation, and most of this you'll see applies to Eastern system as well, you'll see is exactly opposite to what we understand. Now, in practical details, let's take a few and you'll see. First of all, there's a verse in the Torah which says a remarkable thing. The verse says like this. Was there ever an experience? Now the verse in Chumash, the Pasuk says, was there ever such an experience in the history of the world? I'm paraphrasing the Pasuk. That Hashem came and took one nation out of another nation, goy mikerev goy. The Pasuk says it's like a shepherd puts his hand inside an animal and helps her give birth. He takes the young outside from inside a mother animal. Was there ever such an experience that Hashem did that? Went inside a nation to deliver, to give birth to another nation, and then that he did everything that he did with all the wonders and miracles that he did for us. And the Pasuk describes that whole reality, the whole pathway from being born in Egypt, which is a whole mystical story, how Hashem which means the essence of purity, could engage in the country, could actually be present in a country that was the climax of impurity, that's a whole mystical discussion, that he could take us out of there with a complete revelation of all the mystical worlds and spheres, and then that he could bring us to Sinai, and a whole description like that. But what's remarkable about the pasuk is the last few words. It says, O hanishma kamogu. That's the word that it puts on at the end. Loosely translated, those words mean, in English, has there ever been such a thing? And has there ever been purported to be such a thing? In other words, loosely expressed in English it would be, has there ever been a mystical experience like that? And then, at the end, and has anyone even claimed that there was such an experience? Let's try to understand this. It means the following thing. Was there ever an experience like this in the history of the world? Let's check it out and see. And when we've checked it out, you'll notice that not only was there never ever an experience of that kind, but that nobody's even ever pretended or claimed that there was. Understand well. First of all, we have a strong tradition that when the Sinai revelation occurred, we all stood there. The whole Jewish nation, 600,000 people between certain ages, about 3 million people all in all. About 3 million people stood there and witnessed that intense revelation. Everybody saw and experienced exactly the same thing, and there's not one dissenting opinion. By the way, there's not only not one dissenting opinion recorded from then, there's not been one dissenting opinion ever expressed in history. That's a remarkable thing. If you take any other religion, if you take the Christian revelation, Saul, not Saul of Tarsus, what they call Paul, who was a Jew, who had the famous vision on the Damascus Road. Now he came back and he said to the Jews that he was walking, I'm sure you're familiar with the thing, he had a famous revelation and the creator of the world appeared to him and told him that the founder of Christianity had said certain things and he was corrected. So the Jews scoffed and scorned him out of the possibility of even speaking to Jews. They didn't take it seriously at all. Whereas in our tradition, we've never yet heard ever recorded an opinion that suggests that it didn't happen. It's a remarkable thing. Examine this further. For example, we say that 3 million people stood and experienced this particular revelation. Do you know that in every single recorded case in history, to the best of my knowledge, of a divine revelation, of a claimed divine revelation, there was never more than one person present alone? It's a remarkable thing. Let's just check this out a little bit. It's a real Jewish chutzpah. They can't even bring themselves, even the out and out liars, can't bring themselves to claim even one witness. And we say that no one didn't see it. We say that all 3 million people stood there and experienced the same thing together. They can't even claim to cook up one witness ever for a revelation. It's a remarkable thing. If you check out the history of revelation, of so-called divine revelations, you'll see that they all occurred to one person alone. To the best of my knowledge, I might be wrong someplace, but if you can find an exception, I don't think this proves the point. But I'm not aware of an exception. The founder of Christianity, for example. First of all, the whole concept of his revelation is nothing like what it's cooked up to be in the later sources. But he was very close to Orthodox tradition. Significantly different. Different enough to be, for the Gemara to say the most horrendous things about him. I'm not happy with the types too much detail, but Gemara is a talk about him. But where the whole thing began was with a friend of his who lived, or a follower who lived sometime later, 200 years later approximately. The date's also been falsified by Christian history. The Ramban points out, proves that actually the date was much longer. The first of the Synoptic Gospels was written much later, a number of centuries later after his life. They falsified it by about 170 years, 200 odd years, in order to make it appear closer to the time when the events occurred. And the Ramban had to leave Spain on pain of death for that. But that's the story. Their revelation was to one man alone. Paul was a non-epileptic. He came back and said that he had a vision. And the Jews asked him, who was with you at the time? Do you have any witnesses? It's very nice what you're saying. Did anybody see it with you? He said, no, he was alone and he merited to have this vision all by himself. So the Jews said, well, you know, that's very nice, but ours is corroborated by a lot of witnesses. You know, we have a tradition that tells us that we all stood, we all saw this thing together, and that revelation told us that there would never be a revelation like yours. Well, the two are mutually exclusive. Our revelation told us that there would never be any modification or addition to it. You come along and tell us that you have a revelation that overrides ours, but you don't have one single proof, one witness, not even one. And because of that fact, they weren't prepared to listen even to his revelation, and that's why he developed the principle, what they call the cycle of all nations, that he went out and he tried to get other non-Jews to follow him because the Jews weren't interested. In the year 800 or so, the founder of Islam, we had a similar experience. The Rambam refers to him in very, very strong terms. Again, I'm not prepared to use the language, but the Rambam refers to him in extremely strong terms and says that he said that he had a revelation. He came out of his tent and he said that the creator of the world revealed to him the book that they have. Not word for word, dictated to him this book. That book is a major problem because it has major errors. You're probably aware, it's just a paraphrasing of the Old Testament. I don't know if you're aware of that. The chapters of that book which they read are named after the figures of the Old Testament. It isn't a new document. One of the chapters is called Yunus, which is Jonah. One is Dawood, which is David. Right? It's just a description. Except it's got a few events mixed up, the chronology's wrong, and various other mistakes. Anyway, he came back and said that this was a revelation that he was given. So the Jews asked him if anyone witnessed the revelation with him, maybe just one person happened to overhear it. And he said no, he was alone in his tent at the time, and so no one was prepared to listen. And if you check out the history of revelations, you'll see that everyone who ever claimed a revelation never claimed to have had a witness. It's a remarkable, remarkable fact. Even down to the certain churches which were begun in the 1800s. In America, church was begun by a certain individual who said that he was visited by certain visitations, told him a whole prophecy about seven planets, and you probably know what I'm referring to. Certain races weren't allowed to join that church, and at a certain stage, one of them leaders had a dream during the unrest of the civil rights movement and said that there was a new revelation that said that people of that particular race are now allowed to join that church. But in all these revelations, right down to this modern version of it, again, it was somebody who claimed to have that revelation only on his own. There was no corroboration. Now, the remarkable fact is this. There are many thinkers who take this line. We know that out there, among that system of revelations, we know that somebody's lying. We know that at least somebody's lying, because many of them are mutually contradictory. You know that the Christians and the Muslims call each other infidels and dogs, and they've been engaged in battles to the death, massacres of each other, right, because of the mutually exclusive nature of their two revelations. Well, somebody out there is lying. We're not saying who, but somebody somewhere is lying. So if you're lying already, so pay a witness. What, you follow? So you're lying already. You're trying to foist something on people that's not true. So if you're going that far already, so pay a witness. So what it means, what we understand from this, when the Apostle says, oh, hanishma kamo, means that nobody's even had the audacity to even pretend that there was more than one person present during a revelation. It's a remarkable fact that stands out in the history of spiritual experience. We don't answer questions on a Monday night. Okay? I just can't do that. I just can't get through the subject. I can't get through the subject at all anyway. Okay? So we have especially set aside a Sunday night, especially for questions. And I'm very happy that if you want to speak to me afterwards or come then, I'll do my best. I probably can't answer a question anyway. Okay, so we have here in front of us a remarkable thing. Let's start to separate carefully our experience from other experiences of this kind. And our aim here is not to mock or put down any other system, right? That is a Jewish subject in its own right, what we think about other systems and how much truth we believe certain of them have and don't have. It's not tonight's subject. But the elements that we need for this discussion we must draw out. So the first fact we have is this, that we claim that we experienced a certain experience, all of us together, right? And there's no dissension ever about that fact that we've ever heard, and they never have been able to even have one witness present in the room. Secondly, many thinkers also take this line, Jewish and non-Jewish. If you wish to include the non-Jewish testimony, if you want to look at non-Jewish testimony about this thing, if you're not so convinced about the invalidity of certain aspects of their claims, you can look at what they say and you'll find that in every case it corroborates us. For example, if you take Islam and Christianity, if you just look at those two, you'll see that of those two combined with us, they all agree on the basic facts. They agree that there was a revelation like we say. Not even our enemies, those who sought to massacre us through the centuries, have claimed that we were wrong about this. They accept that tradition wholeheartedly. The only thing is, they make some later modifications. They add on a certain document onto the end of ours. They say that history took a turn in which we stopped being the chosen people and they became the chosen people. They do things, they add on things, but they don't dispute the basic claim. Which means that it's just in that Western block of religions, you have everybody agree to the basic facts entirely, that there was such a revelation and that it happened to us and that we all saw it. Remarkable thing. On the other hand, what they say about each other is completely mutually exclusive. It's important things to understand. Now, what happened there? That's so much for looking at comparative ideas. What happened there according to our tradition? What actually happened at that? What was that experience? Now, we want to understand this because what we're trying to do here is understand how we in this generation, centuries removed from that revelation, can have any potency left. That means, how can we be sure, how can we have any sensation at all that it happened and that it was what it was supposed to have been? We're so far away that we get a very, very faint whiff of what it must have been. And yet we see that generations of Jews, going on the strength of the story of that experience, were prepared to undergo the most abysmal torture, the most horrific forms of torture, because of the fire that was put into our blood by that experience. It's a remarkable thing. Understand this carefully. But we want to understand how potent an experience must have been for the Jewish people to be able to have generated that. You know that, again, I don't want to go into detail on the subject, but you know that for centuries we lived through torture, right? Possibly more often than not. You're probably aware that the Catholic Church killed 10 million Jews. You're probably aware of that. Much more than the Germans did. And they killed most of them by torture. Not because they were bloody-minded or evil-minded necessarily, but because they wanted them to convert to Christianity. I mean, let's at least give them the credit. At least credit that they weren't just plain sadists. Right? It's not such a clear fact, but at least. But they did it because they thought that this was the way to save ourselves. Right? Let's give them that credit. Right? They tortured us. What happened? 10 million people, including many little children, women and children, and in all... Let me share with you a remarkable fact of history. Later thinkers have said a very, very, very sobering and frightening fact, that the first time that Jews were ever killed without being given a choice was the last destruction. The German destruction that happened in this century was the first time in the history of the world that Jews have ever been destroyed without being given a choice. What does it mean? That on every previous occasion, again, perhaps you'll find an exception, but the pattern has been that when Jews were killed, they were first given a choice: become Greeks like us, and not only will we leave you unmolested, we'll honor you. Become Christians, accept our way, save your souls the way we say, we'll honor you, we'll give you leading positions, we'll give you everything you want. They were always given a choice. Why? Because they could be relied on to make the right choice. Hashem could rely on us to make the right choice. He knew that we'd go through torture rather than make the wrong choice. Many, many times it happened in the Middle Ages. It happened before. The Gemara brings examples. The Rambam brings examples. It happened right up to the 1600s, 1700s. It happened in the 1800s. The Jews were surrounded in a shul. The non-Jews said to them, come out and kiss the cross. Acknowledge Christianity. Kiss the cross and you can go home. And the community burnt to death on that. They lit the shul. They burnt everyone to death on that. And while burning, they never ran out to kiss the cross. That means all they had to do was just pretend to accept somebody else's religion, just to save your life. And they chose to die in torture, consciously, often singing Shema or saying Aleinu, rather than pretend to accept some sadists. That's offer. It's a remarkable fact. Remarkable fact. You need a very, very powerful dose or something in your background to understand that. Centuries after it happened, you need something very, very strong. We don't understand this because we're part of that generation that hasn't a clue what that tradition was. We're part of the generation that in the last 150 years, especially the last 100 years, that awareness, that fire that was generated back then, 3,200 years ago, that fire burnt in our blood, only diving slightly until we reached the exponential phase. We've been in the exponential phase for the last 100-150 years. So we're a generation that not only doesn't know about that experience and what it means, we don't even know that people died for it. We don't even know what they did in Spain in the 1400s. Never mind Europe later. In Spain, they used to take Jews. You know what the bastinado is? I don't want to tell you too much and make it too unpleasant. I'll tell you, the bastinado used to take a Jew, used to cut the soles of his feet, put butter in the cuts, and roast his feet over a fire. And while his feet were being roasted with the butter sizzling in the cuts, they would offer to stop the pain if he would accept Christianity. And 10 million people died rather than do that. Well, you couldn't give us that kind of a choice. There's no question what we would choose. That's why some of the later thinkers have said that when Germany arrived, they were killed without being given a choice. For the first time in Jewish history, we suffered the indignity of being butchered because we were Jews without being able to reach the greatness of making the correct choice. Because we already made the wrong choice. That more than 50% of the Jews in Germany were intermarried. We're not getting into the discussion here of the Holocaust and blame, and so that's another discussion. We'll have to do that some other time. But the point is that we couldn't withstand the same ordeals. And therefore, we had to make a Kiddush Hashem. We had to show what we are as Jews by being killed because we were Jews, but without the dignity and the Kiddush of being offered a choice for it. Well, we couldn't live up to that choice anymore. We made a Kiddush Hashem anyway. But we couldn't do it at the level that we'd done before. But for 3,200 years, Hashem could torture us to death in the most horrific ways, right? And little children could be relied on to withstand that and sing. It's a remarkable fact. You have to add to that the fact that the Jewish people doesn't die easily. There are people who have an ethic of giving your life in a suicidal type of way. There are religions and nations like that. There are people who find it easy. There are people like that. But the Jewish tradition is not to do that. The Jewish tradition is a very, very intense training that life's more important than almost anything else. Those religious Jews, they were almost all, there almost wasn't a soul who wasn't committed to the practice of his religion. I'm not saying they were all learned. They weren't all learned. But they were almost all deeply committed to practicing Yiddishkeit. There's no question about that until this century. And the training in observance of Yiddishkeit is that you don't give your life for anything. You break Shabbos rather than give your life. You eat everything rather than give your life. There are only three cardinal things in certain extreme circumstances that you die rather than do. But the full thrust of Jewish training is that your life's worth more than anything else. And despite that, they were prepared to go to torture and death. It's a remarkable thing that it is. On top of that, you have to understand that the Jewish people who gave their lives en masse in those situations is a people that's very, very critically questioned. If you want to find one nation on earth that when pressure's put on will come up with 50 different opinions and reasons about why you should be able to get out of the situation in 50 different ways, it's the Jewish people. They're not a sheep-minded mentality where they just go en masse to a certain thing. It's well known that we're not like that. Our training is to think critically, and when the pressure's on, to be able to come up with ingenious ways of getting out of danger. And yet they didn't do that. These are remarkable facts that we have to understand. And if we went through that kind of experience for so many centuries, it's worth understanding what generated that power. What was it that a father said to his son? What did parents say? What did a child, a little Jewish child, see in his mother, right when he was 3 and 4 and 5, that enabled him to be burnt to death when he was 6 and 7, and sing while he was undergoing that torture? What did he see? That's a remarkable tradition that had to be handed down that could do that to people. The only bigger tragedy than their death is that we don't even know about it. The bigger tragedy than those millions who were butchered in that way is that we don't even, never mind being proud about it, we don't even know what happened. Never mind being prepared to do the same thing ourselves. So let's take a step back and let's try and understand what exactly that experience was and what kind of a fire it lit in the Jewish neshama that lasted for so many centuries, that was able to take us to now, not until this desperate situation where we have almost nothing left. That's true. But until now we made it. Let's try and examine that fire and its transmission. But the first thing to understand is that the Sinai experience was not, you see, we've had our ideas of that perverted also. We have statements that God came down on the mountain, you know, so inevitably you have this picture of a man in a sky with a white beard appearing on the mountain, or some other childish image that's complete opposite of transcendence. What we're trying to understand is that the Jews experienced the spiritual world at that time. That means that we experienced transcendence so deeply that it impinged itself into our genes. That means within Jewish blood, from that day on, there burned a love for transcendence, for the spiritual world, for the spiritual experience, that was unquenched even by torture. Now, what was that fire and how was it put in? You know, if you read Shir HaShirim, you want to understand the depth of this and the emotion, you should read Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. That was a work that was almost not included in the canon because of its sensual nature. It describes the love between a young husband and wife in very, very graphic terms. In such graphic terms that the most recent English translation was decided not to translate it literally because he just couldn't translate it literally. And the translation was done allegorically, with a literal translation in brackets only underneath. And you can read that and study it. But it's an intense song of love between a young husband and his wife. And what it's teaching is the love between Hashem and us. Right? And the love between us was so intense that no degree of torture would ever sway us at all, until now, from pursuing that love. Yishakeni minishiko espiu, it says, that he should kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. What does it mean? What were the kisses of his mouth? That was when we received Torah. When we stood at Sinai and we received that kiss, we never forgot it. No matter what torture he would put us through after that, we never broke loyalty. Until now. What was that kiss? What was that experience? So the Gemara describes it in detail. The Gemara says that what happened was that we were instantaneously lifted into the world of total and complete transcendence. That means you have to realize that to get the kind of inspiration and fire that we're talking about, that made millions of Jews risk anything in order to keep a mitzvah, that made millions of Jews, many generations of Jews, do anything and give up anything in the world for the pleasure of Torah learning,
that had to be an experience that was so elevating that even just telling it over in a Jewish family would be elevating enough that a child would be unable to resist. Now they say, one of the commentaries says, in trying to explain, you see, what we have to understand is that in the tradition of this wonderful experience, we have the fact that the generation that actually experienced that transcendence, when they told it over to their children in the desert, in the next 40 years there were children born, those children were hearing from their parents about this Sinai experience, but they didn't see it themselves. That's an enormous drop in voltage when that happens. And the grandchildren told in the next generation that my father told me that he stood at Sinai and experienced this, but that child is hearing it two generations removed. How did the Jewish people, how inspired were they that they were able to give it over to a child, to another child, that many, many generations later, a child still heard it powerfully enough to be so inspired that he was still prepared to give his life without question. You know, that must have been the most amazing experience, such that the transmission must have been already burning enough. There's a wonderful commentary that says the following idea, just to give you a faint hint of it. It says that, you know, the main core of this experience is the Pesach Seder. I don't know if you're aware of that, but the main time when the fire is lit in a child is those few hours that he sits around the table on Pesach. There's almost no time the rest of the year. We do try, but that amazing experience and the time of year especially mystically set up in such a way that the spiritual forces operate, that fire can be lit at that time. That's why in the springtime, that's how a person can transcend to levels that they can't reach the rest of the year. But when the children sit around the table, and that's why the Seder is always geared towards the children, that experience lights a child's imagination, and it drives into his consciousness such an awareness of what that experience must have been to be welded together into a nation with a transcendent core, transcendent beginning, that from that time on, the child is never the same. Some of the Mephoshim say a remarkable thing. In Tanakh, there's a description of Gideon, leader of the Jewish people in that generation. He was visited by an angel. He had a prophetic revelation in which an angel appeared to him. Now, the Tanakh says clearly that when the angel appeared to him, he had a question for the malach, for the angel. The malach appeared to him to tell him a prophecy. Gideon responded to the malach by saying, "Where are your signs and wonders?" Now, what does that conversation mean? It's a beautiful, beautiful thing that we can hear in it. Some of the commentaries say this. You have to understand the following thing. When a malach appears to you, you don't ask any questions. When an angel appears, you don't ask questions. Yet again, we think, again, let's try and elevate ourselves, okay, beyond the pathetic level that we've been brought up with. An angel appears to somebody does not mean that Gideon was walking down the road someplace and a little fat child with wings flapping on his back arrived out of the sky, so to speak. This is what it means. It means that he was suddenly elevated into the spiritual world. He suddenly had a consciousness that bonded him into reality. So powerfully, that the Rambam says that when a person reaches that level of prophetic revelation, he falls on the floor, totally out of control of his faculties and his body. Because the body is so blasted out of action, we'll learn that at Sinai, when Hashem appeared to the Jewish people, it says that bodies were the neshama stayed where they were, but the bodies were blasted back 12 miles. That means the body is totally inactivated when a person has a revelation of transcendence. So Gideon, so that was it. So in other words, when a person experiences prophecy, what he certainly didn't do at the time was turn over his cassette. When a person experiences a revelation of that transcendent level, right, experiences a direct connection with the divine, it's a completely transcendent, it's nothing that we can begin to describe in words. The last thing that a person does in such a situation is start questioning the revelation. You follow? Gideon turned around to the malach and he said, "Where are your signs and wonders? You speak that way to a malach?" How could he generate in himself the energy to be able to stand up and ask a question like that? It's impossible. The Mephoshim say it's an impossible thing to understand. What's the explanation? Remarkable explanation. It was the first day of Pesach. That's what they saw. It was the first day of Pesach. What does it mean? You know what it means? It means that the night before, he sat at his father's table.
What he certainly didn't do at the time was turn over his cassette.
When a person experiences a revelation of that transcendent level, right, experiences a direct connection with the divine, it's a completely transcendent, it's nothing that we can begin to describe in words. The last thing that a person does in such a situation is start questioning the revelation. You follow? Gideon turned around to the malach and he said, "Where are your signs and wonders?" You speak that way to a malach? How could he generate in himself the energy to be able to stand up and ask a question like that? It's impossible. The Mephoshim said it's an impossible thing to understand. What's the explanation?
remarkable explanation. It was the first day of Pesach. That's what they say. It was the first day of Pesach. What does it mean? You know what it means? It means that the night before, he sat at his father's table. And his father described to him what it was like to have a transcendent experience. He described to him, with the other children around the table, the going out of Egypt, and what transcendent experience we had there. And he was so imbued with that experience. Now, a man of that greatness, he was just so alive in his consciousness, that experience, that when he had the first inkling of divine thing, the first thing he said, where are signs and wonders? That means what he expected. A remarkable thing. It's a beautiful, beautiful chat in that piece of thing. But the fact is that that's what happens to children when they're told over that story. So let's try and understand. It says that when we stood there, this is what happened. Let's just get the facts clear. 3 million people, it said, stood at a point verging on total superhuman transcendence. For 3 days, they prepared themselves. For 6 days, they prepared. For 3 days, they prepared themselves in a very, very careful way. Right? Husbands and wives were separate in a very, very special way. And they prepared themselves for a pitch of meditational transcendent experience. And when it happened, the Gemara says this is what happened. That when Hashem spoke the first time, now, they had to keep far away from the mountain. Right? They weren't allowed to go beyond a certain stage. Because the voltage was so high that there was no way to survive the experience. The danger always with a spiritual revelation is that a person may not survive it. Right? That's why anybody who was ever visited by a prophetic experience, the first thing they had was a fear that they wouldn't live. Why? Just trying to understand it in its depth. The mystics say that when you have an experience of the divine, that means you see the root of things higher than you're normally used to seeing them. The root of a thing is always closer to unity than the branches. The closer you get to unity, the closer you get to a place where your own differentiation as a person hasn't begun. The closer you get to a place where everything is all one. If you get high enough, you get to a place where you don't exist. If you want to understand it, if you want to make a graphic situation out of which you're not really allowed to do beyond a certain level, it's as if Hashem's oneness is so all-encompassing that if you were there, you certainly wouldn't be you. Because at that level, there is only oneness. There is only Him. That's how the Nevi Shechaim puts it. At that level, there is only Him. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu only see 49 of the 50 possible levels? Why couldn't he see the 50th? Because the 50th level is a level of such intense unity that at that level, He doesn't exist. You couldn't see there. Not that He was punished or He wasn't great enough, but had He would be seeing into the root of where His own beginning hadn't yet differentiated out from Hashem's oneness, if you're with me. Now, you have to be very careful with these ideas. And therefore, the problem is if you see too much, you couldn't survive it. Not as a punishment, but because you... So that'll keep at a certain... What happened? When Hashem spoke, it says that they all died. 3 million people died instantaneously. What does the Gemara say? They died, which means... The experience of death means that the neshama flew out towards Hashem. Are we making it very crude and graphic, but we don't have any other words. The neshamas flew out towards Hashem, and the bodies were blasted back 12 mil, 12, which is about 12 kilometers. Now, why that distance, I'm not going to go into now. What happened? It says that when Hashem wanted to speak the second of the Ten Commandments, but the Jews weren't alive. First of all, why did they die? Well, mystically, what we understand is that when the neshama is faced with its source, it doesn't stick around with you or me. When the neshama, yeah, the problem with the neshama is that it's forced into a body that it detests. The mystics say that the neshama, the human soul, is forced to live inside a body that it detests. Their body is the opposite of the place where the neshama belongs. The neshama is a spark of transcendence that's a spark of infinity. A spark of infinity is infinity. Right? We don't understand what that means, but we have inside us something, and anybody who's sensitive to that all can feel that he goes way beyond the piece of meat that he walks around in. Anybody with any sensitivity can feel that the piece of steak that he inhabits, that is a very, very, very lowest element of what he's being is. This generation doesn't understand it because that's what they're busy with out there. They're busy out there selling the piece of steak. That's all they're interested in. So we've lost that. But anybody with any sensitivity left can feel that that's only a vehicle, right? And it's only a very, very peripheral part of who he is. What you really are inside is something that can never be squeezed into that finite piece of tissue. So the first thing that the neshama has a problem is that she's squeezed into something finite. She's an infinite being, and she's forced into the confines of a finite being. That's the biggest negation of her own existence. And she's tremendously, it said that the pain that a neshama has when it's forced down to this world, and a neshama doesn't want to come down here. When a child is born, the neshama says to Hashem, please don't do that to me. That's what it says. The neshama says to Hashem, please do not do that to me. I'm where I belong. Do not put me into a finite piece of space. I can't handle that. Right? And then there's a whole discussion, and eventually she agrees. It's not tonight's subject. Secondly, she's put into a body that's full of excrement. Not just is she squeezed into a finite space, but she's put into something that's smelly, that's crude, right? That's a tremendous, tremendous suffering for the neshama. She comes from a place of purity. The Chofetz Chaim explains, a long mashal. Chofetz Chaim says that it's like a princess who happened to marry a peasant. And he took her home to his hut in the field. And all she can remember, right, is the court and how it was in the royal palace, and the court music and the courtiers and everything that was refined in the, and she's living with a peasant who tries to make her happy. He brings home the salami, or he tries to make her happy with some crude aspect of his life that absolutely fills her with disgust. That's what it is. That's the marriage between the neshama and the body. And this neshama is squeezed into her body. The only reason she hangs on is there's nowhere else for her to go, right? She's married and bonded to this body, and the Midrash says that there's a special, Hashem puts in a special mystical connection that makes her want to stay. But there's no understanding. If you want to know, the Midrash says that when Hashem says to the child, when Hashem takes the neshama and says, I'm going to make you be born, I'm going to put you into a body of a child, and you'll be born in the world, the neshama starts to cry and says, please do not put me there. So then Hashem says to the neshama, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just put you in for a second, and then you can decide whether you want to stay or not. So it says the neshama of the child agrees. The person's neshama agrees. And Hashem puts the neshama in the child for just an instant, and then the neshama says, please don't kill me. That's what happens. That's what happens. But it's a special mystical creation that induces the neshama to stay inside the body. But when that neshama is faced with its source, then it doesn't stay with the body. So when Hashem appeared, when the infinite, the source of reality, appeared on the mountain, the neshama didn't stay with the body. That's what it means to die. The neshama flew out to where it belongs. And the body, which is the opposite, the crude, the side that can't stand that level of kedusha, the bodies were blasted in the opposite. We have to understand what these things mean, and not to get a childish picture of what they mean. Try to understand them in their transcendence. What happened next? It says that when Hashem wanted to speak the second of the Ten Commandments, so the angels, certain spiritual forces, the malachim, they went and they gathered the Jewish people and they revived them. They helped them. Hashem revived them, and the angels had to help them forward to Sinai. Medadin Oysan, it says, they sort of helped them stumble and hobble forward back to the mountain so they could hear the next of the Ten Commandments. When Hashem spoke the second of the Ten Commandments, everyone died again in the same way. It says the world was filled with a smell of certain incense, certain spices, a very, very pervasive smell of beauty. Everyone died, and the same thing happened again. Then it says that Hashem revived them a second time, and as he brought them forward to the mountain, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, that's enough. They said, you hear and you tell us, we've seen enough. And Hashem said it was quite correct what they did. They couldn't take more, it was correct. And we never heard another word directly from Hashem. What we all heard, the revelation that the Jewish people experienced, was only two statements that we heard from Hashem. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, and lo yiyeh lecha, there should be no other gods before me. The positive and negative statement of the same fact. Right? Anochi Hashem Elokecha means they heard I am Hashem. What it really means is they experienced it. It means they actually bonded with that reality. It means their neshamas flew out and became part of that reality before they were put back in a body. But when they were put back in a body, they had the fire of once having been there. We tried to explain before that this fire was lit. The root of this fire was lit when Isaac, Yitzchak, was offered up as a sacrifice on the altar. He also went through death then. He went through death in the spiritual sense. He also, we tried to explain before that the word Yitzchak spells Keitz Chai, which, if you look at the word Yitzhak, break it down, you'll see it spells Keitz Chai, which means death in life. That means that what a Jewish person is a person who's living in this world after having experienced the next world. Right? We live opposite to everybody else. We live in this world after having been through death. That's Melech Kiddush for us. We begin, right, where that ends. We just begin in this world after the impossible has finished. That's what we are. And at Sinai, we all experience that together. Let's try and take one more aspect of this experience to understand its depth. What we want to try and understand here is just a refined, very, very amazing and refined spiritual idea to try and understand the elevation of that experience. What does it mean to bond with the infinite? Right? doesn't mean anybody came down on the mountain. When it says that Hashem appeared on the mountain, what it means is that the infinite and the finite became one, which is completely impossible, but it happened. Just like a human neshama inside a physical body is impossible, but that's the human experience. We understand this as follows. If you look carefully in Chumash, you see we're so used to reading it in a childish, insensitive way that we don't understand, we don't even see the words. Look carefully in Chumash, and you'll see that the description of the Sinai experience is as follows. It says that there were very loud sounds. You remember that? The shofar, the sound of the shofar, we tried to discuss this Yom Kippur time, the sound of the shofar was very loud. But if you look carefully at the words, it says, Royin es hakolos, they saw the sounds. Correct? It says they saw the sounds. It doesn't say they heard them. This is a remarkable statement. What does it mean, they saw the sounds? What are the Chumash trying to tell us? What transcendent idea is being described? Maybe we'll finish with this. I see it's late already. It's not time. We'll have to continue maybe the rational next time, and we'll get to the mystical the time after that. You'll have to come back. But let's try and just understand this idea. To see the sounds means the following idea, as best as we can put it into words. And I'm going to try and explain this idea because there's many applications other than the specific that we're using it for. You know, it says that when Hashem appeared on the mountain, everything stood still in the world. Everything stood still. That means not a single atom spun, not a leaf fell, nothing in the creation moved at all. That's what it says in the mystical writings, in the Kabbalistic writings. What does it mean? It says that in open sources also, but the Kabbalistic writings explain. It means the following thing. What does movement mean? What is the concept of movement? Movement means always fulfillment of a lack. Something that's moving means it's moving towards a place where it should be and it's not. Yeah? To a zone of lower pressure or greater attraction. A thing only moves when there's a force moving it. When a thing's not moving, it means it's at peace, at shleimus, when it's where it should be. There's no force acting to move it out of that position. Movement always implies, correct, a lack. It means the energy level isn't as low as it should be. There's still something impelling something to move to a new state. That's what movement means. That's why the mystics say that this world is a world of movement. The word eretz, aretz, which means the world, means running. Ratz means to move. Because this world is always moving. Where is it moving towards? Shamayim. The dimension that's called the infinite is called Shamayim. In English they translate it as heaven. But it couldn't be a stupider translation. It got nothing to do with being up or in space. Shamayim means the transcendent dimension. If you really look at the word Shamayim carefully, it spells Shamim. Shamim means anything you can say there about. Right? Because it's there that you're going to. There there's no movement. There can be no movement there because everything's arrived where it should be. So in mystical terms, this world is a place of movement going towards what? Towards the next world. The next world, or the infinite revelation, is a world where there's no movement because that's, by definition, what has arrived. Now. These two modalities of movement and stillness, the human being experiences in sight and sound. Seeing and hearing are the ways that we grasp these two elements. How's that? So the mystics say as follows. It's a fantastic idea to understand. Your eyes and your ears, which are the two highest modalities in the mystical system, they're the things that come first. First comes the forehead, which is closed and blank. We're not going to talk about that now, but then come the eyes and then come the ears, going downwards in the mystical system. The difference between them is this. Your eyes see, or the way the mystics describe it, your eyes see things outside of you, but your ears hear things inside of you. What they mean is this. Your eyes experience something the way it is all at once. When you see a scene, you see all the elements of the scene at once, and they're all there. But when you hear, and that's called the world of stillness, because you see it as it is instantaneously. But when you hear something, you experience the world of movement. When you see, you experience the next world. When you hear, you experience this world. Why? Because when you hear, the way you hear a thing is like this. First you hear one syllable, then the next, then the next, then the next, then the next. But when you hear the second sound, the first one has disappeared already. Is that correct? When somebody says a sentence to you, they say one sound, then the next, and it takes time. By the time you hear the second sound, the first one has disappeared. It's only a memory. By the time you hear the third, the second is only a memory. And it doesn't yet make sense. Correct? The only time it makes sense is when the whole thing has become a memory and it's over, and then you construct in your own being what's been said. A remarkable thing. Of course, you can hear with your eyes also, and you can see with your ears also. Right? But it's the eyes and the ears that are just placed to teach us these things. Again, When you see a thing, you see it into, and that's why the word re'iyah in Hebrew, which means to see, is also re'ayah, which means a proof. Because it's proven. Once you see it, it's proven. When you hear a thing, it's not a proof at all. When you hear a thing, it's no proof, because it depends on how you hear it. Is it correct? You hear one thing, then the next, then the next, and if you put it together correctly, you hear it, but if you don't, you don't. When you see something, you have no option. That's why seeing is believing. Right? Re'iyah is re'ayah. And by the way, mystically, for those who are mystically inclined, that's why the word re'iyah adds up to Aryeh. If you rearrange the letters of Re'iyah, it spells Aryeh, which means a lion. Because that's the source of power in the world. That's the thing that forces itself on. You can't move. Re'iyah. Also, it's the Gematria of Gvura. Other things also. Now, but hearing is up to you how you reconstruct. You hear in the darkness, you see in the light. Which means that in this world you can only hear. And what we try and develop in this world is hearing. That's why when people struggle in Gemara, trying to hear and put together the fractured, broken pieces of truth in the world, to reconstruct the truth in oneself, and that's why Gemara always gives you the broken pieces before it gives you the completion. Gemara doesn't describe the thing the way it ends up. Gemara takes you to 55 different wrong opinions, correct? Before it gets to the correct one, because it wants you to reconstruct the broken pieces within yourself. That's why the Gemara, fascinating thing, the Gemara, when it wants you to understand something, it always says Tashma. It introduces the subject by saying Tashma. Tashma means come in here, come in here. But the Yerushalmi and the Zohar, mystical writings, they never say Tashma. They say Tachazi, come and see. Isn't that beautiful? When you read Gemara, which is only darkness, it's only confusion, and the only clarity in Gemara is what you get yourself. The Gemara is totally unclear. Take a page of Gemara and read it once through, you could not imagine such confusion. Anybody's tried it knows. And the only clarity you get is what it does to you in your mind. That's Tashma. But when you read the Zohar, when you read the Kabbalistic writings and you see the emes, you actually experience it, it says, Tachazi, come and see me. You with me? So those are the two experiences. Those are the two modalities, seeing and hearing. Now, so what follows from this? That whatever you experience in this world is only hearing. Because this world is moving. Movement is always one thing, then the next, then the next, then the next. So everything that happens in this world, you hear. But in the next world, everything that happens, you see. Because the next world, the totality of existence and reality and purpose is all apparent at once. There is no movement. Movement implies that I'm going someplace where I need to go. But the next world is all here now. There's no place to go. So that's what it means that when the Torah was given, nothing in the world moved. Because everything, when Hashem arrived in the world, it means Shamayim, the dimension of there, arrived here. That means there was no here and there anymore. You follow? When we stood at Sinai, all the tachlis of the world, all the theres, all the place that things are moving to, all arrived here. So no atom spun because it was already where it was spinning to. Nothing moved at all because it was where it was should be. That's why no movement was possible. And that's why it says they saw the sounds. Because the sound of the... You follow? Sound is that modality which moves through time. But there was no time. The Sinai experience was where everything happened together, all in one infinite instant. And therefore, all you could do then was see. And of course, that's why they had no free choice. Because they saw it was a proof. Re'iyah. Re'ayah was a proof. And therefore, the sound of the shofar couldn't be heard. It could only be seen because it was in totality at once. That's what it means. Alright, let's leave it there for this evening. What we've discussed is, let's summarize and try and say what we didn't say, what we didn't have time for. The pathway to knowledge that we're trying to work on is, first of all, to experience the fact of what it means that we once met this experience directly. It's much more important than the second modality, which is trying to examine the physical world and infer or deduce from it that there must be a transcendent source. That itself is perfectly valid, but it's not nearly as important and not nearly as powerful as the fact that we actually experience this reality. That's why I began with it. The commentaries say that you can go wrong when you look at the world. You can infer the wrong conclusion. You might deduce the wrong conclusion. Right? You might deduce that there's a transcendence and get wrong what it is. You can go wrong by looking at the world. Not if you're totally objective, but if you're not, you can go wrong. Whereas, if you trust fully in the accurate transmission of what's been handed down to us, you won't go wrong. Okay? That's the transmission of Torah knowledge, which goes back to the time when we actually experienced it. What did we discuss this evening? Just the beginning of what we're supposed to understand. Now, just what we're supposed to understand in what that tremendous fiery experience was when we stood at Sinai. What we'll have to try and work through now is the rest of that experience, and more important, various other things that went with it, right, that are part of our tradition of transcendence is what we experienced then. And then what we'll have to do is try and work through the transmission of this experience. Who were the people who said this to their children? Who were they? What was their level of integrity? What features does the transmission have that other systems and other so-called spiritual revelations and so forth don't have? Okay? What does our tradition have that they don't? How reliable is it?
How much can we rely on this thing that our fathers told us that their fathers told them? We'll have to examine it. And when we threw that in Mitzvah, we'll have to examine how one looks at the physical world and how one abstracts from physical reality what the root must be. And when we finish that, Amit Hashem, we'll try and discuss the very difficult area of intimate, intrinsic spiritual knowledge, that which actually can't be put into words.